Good morning. This may surprise you, but I was never a great wrestler. It was my middle school PE teacher, Mr. Weir, that convinced me to take up the sport. See, he was convinced of two things. First, he believed that wrestling took brains, and he thought that I had them. So he thought that I was destined to win a lot of wrestling matches. But Mr. Weir was wrong. Instead of winning a lot, I lost a lot. My poor mother, lamenting the days of coming to wrestling matches, seeing her son twisted into uncomfortable shapes and losing matches. I was a very scrawny 10th grade kid. I may have had a little bit of brains, but that was about all I had. And it turns out that wasn't enough to win wrestling matches. But in those days, I did what a lot of underdog athletes do. I prayed. And as I prayed, there was one biblical story that kept coming to my mind that would give me hope as I would face some menacing boy that looked a lot bigger and stronger than me. Of course, it was the story of David and Goliath. See, I thought if this young shepherd boy could defeat the giant, then surely a scrawny 10th grader could beat a strong 12th grader, right? Doesn't it work that way? Well, right at the beginning of this 10-month journey learning about David, we've called this series A Life of Passion. We're trying to understand who this character is, this David, who features so prominently in the Old Testament. There's more narrative material about David than any other character except for Jesus. He is the one who comes to prepare us for Christ. We started off by looking at Saul, at the contrast to David. Then last week, Andy took us through the first two introductions to the character of David. First, we saw him being anointed by Samuel and then playing harp for King Saul. Andy helped us think about times of transition and how God calls us into moments of change. And this week, we're looking at the third story that completes the introduction of David. And this is for sure the most well-known story in the Old Testament. Probably, I'd argue, the most well-known ancient story in all of Western literature. Of course, it's the story of David and Goliath. We've met David as the forgotten son, we've met him as the gentle harpist, and now we meet him as the confident warrior. Now we see him defeating the giant. The story of David and Goliath is well-known for good reason. It is a masterfully written story. It operates on a ton of different levels. We teach our kids this story because it reminds us that God can defeat even the things that seem undefeatable. But the truth is, the story goes way deeper than that. I learned something from years of losing wrestling matches. The story of David and Goliath isn't about defeating all the giants in your life, at least not in the way I wanted it to be. Not if your giants are stronger high school boys. The story of David and Goliath is a character study. This helps us to meet this man who would be Israel's king and eventually whose throne Jesus will inherit. This is the first story where David is a hero. And in particular, in this story, we see David in contrast to the king who sits on the throne, Saul. In fact, I would say this story is mostly about David and Saul. And how much more kingly David seems than the guy who's currently sitting on the throne. But even in this early story, we start to see these hints of aspects of David's character that we don't quite know what to do with. Curious things. We've seen that David's heart is really important. And as we read this story, we're going to walk away with some questions about his heart. It's not exactly that we know for sure that he does things for bad reasons, but we just have questions. We're not exactly sure why David does all the things he does. And this is going to be important for us because we ask the same questions of ourselves. What is really going on in our hearts? Why do we do the things we do? And ultimately, what's more important, what we do or why we do it? Is it really the thought that counts, or does the result matter? Do the things we do actually matter more than the reasons we do them? How do we discern our actions in the midst of the swirl of motivations that exist within us? David's story is going to help us with that question. We're going to start off by walking through the story. We'll notice some details that maybe aren't the biggest details, but they show us this picture of David and Saul. And then we're going to stop and think about who David is. Who is this guy? And that will lead us then into asking the question of ourselves. Who are we? And what do we do with our motivations? The story in 1 Samuel 17 opens up on a classic military standoff. The nations of Israel and Philistine are pitted against each other, and they're camped at the top of two opposing hills with a valley in between. This would be a classic impasse, because those two armies would know the first army to go down into the valley would give up the high ground and be incredibly vulnerable to the opposing army. So they camped there and they waited. And in the midst of that waiting, a champion steps forward. His name is Goliath. And you've heard about him. You know how impressive he is. His armor alone probably weighed around 125 pounds. He carries a massive javelin and a spear. But he is most remembered for one feature. What is that? He's tall, right? Goliath was huge. There's some debate about how tall he actually was. He's probably about 7 feet tall, a modern-day NBA basketball player. Think Shaquille O'Neal here, all right? That's Goliath. He comes out, and he challenges Israel in 1 Samuel 17, verse 8. He stood, and he shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me." So Goliath throws down the gauntlet. He refers to this army as servants of Saul. And as the story opens, we think it's going to be about Saul. This is his nation. These are his armies. He is the king. How does the king respond when his nation is threatened? Well, we find out quickly. Verse 11 reads this: "When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine," and at this point, we're hopeful. Because remember, why was Saul so impressive? What was it about Saul that the people loved? Why they were so excited to have him as their king? What was Saul? He was tall. So if you're reading the story, you think this is great. It's perfect. There's a tall champion, but no problem. We've got a tall king. And kings fight champions. Kings defeat champions. This is exactly the type of situation that Israel is equipped to handle. So we're hopeful. We think our king is going to come in and save the day. Until we finish reading verse 11, which says, "They were dismayed and greatly afraid." Saul, along with everybody else, was terrified of this guy. And our hearts sink. We're so disappointed in our king, the one who's supposed to be there for us. I took my kids along on a camping trip several years ago with some college students, and we were camping by a lake that turned out to be extremely windy. Now, we should have known, because there were a bunch of those wind turbines near there, so, you know, we should have kind of put one and one together. But at night, you'd be lying in your tent, not sleeping, because we were scared, and you'd hear the wind coming over the hill, this massive rumbling, and you would know that it was coming, and then it would just slam into the tent, and everything would shake. And I would, that whole night, I kept my pocket knife in my hand, because I had these visions of me with my two children being carried up off the ground in the tent and dumped in the lake and having to slice out of this tent to prevent us from drowning. So in the middle of the night, as I said, none of us were sleeping, my daughter turns to me in one of these massive rumbling wind approaches, and she says, "Daddy, I'm scared." And I looked at her and said, Me too. I got nothing for you. I'm sorry. I know I'm supposed to be your dad, but I'm just as scared as you are. And that's, I think, what Saul was here. The people wanted something from him. Saul, we're scared. And all I can say is, me too. I got nothing. But right after this verse, we meet someone else for the third time. David is introduced. He's described as the youngest of eight sons, the leftover child. He's only a messenger to his three older brothers who were doing the real work of being a soldier. But when he gets to the camp, he does something surprising. Listen to verse 22. And David left the things, that is, the food he was carrying, in charge of the keeper of the baggage, and ran to the ranks, that would be the front lines of the soldiers, and went and greeted his brothers. Now, David is supposed to be a messenger, but this is not what a messenger does. A messenger delivers his goods, but David leaves his goods. And who does he leave them with? The keeper of the baggage. Remember another small detail. A couple stories earlier, when the whole nation was gathered and they were trying to publicly select their king, Saul's lot was drawn. They couldn't find Saul. Where was he? He was hiding under the baggage. But here David comes and he leaves his stuff with the baggage and he steps forward. So in Saul's greatest moment, he shrank back and hid under the luggage. In David's greatest moment, he leaves his stuff with the luggage and he goes forward, not acting like a messenger, but acting like a soldier. Remember, I said that this story is about David over against Saul. Score one for David here. So as David approaches the battle line, he hears the challenge of this champion, Goliath. But what really interests David is the reward that is promised to the one who would defeat the giants. Apparently, Saul has promised riches, he's promised to give his daughter in marriage, and he's promised freedom for the family of the man who would kill Goliath. And David recognizes that this is a huge win. Economically, you're provided for. Professionally, you're welcomed into the royal family. That's a huge promotion. And socially, your family is free for generations to come. David is very keen on this reward. In fact, the first words out of David's mouth that we ever hear in this story are him asking about the reward. Listen to verse 26. And David said to the men who stood by him, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And in this scene, we recognize something about David. He wants to be king. He wants to marry the king's daughter. In fact, the theme of the king's daughter will come up over and over again in the subsequent stories. David wants to take this next step. And again, it's a contrast to Saul. When Saul was chosen to be king, he didn't want it. He did everything he could to get rid of that responsibility. But David is ambitious. He wants to marry the king's daughter. He wants to move up. Remember, last week, Andy talked about how after David was anointed, he trusted God to let God work behind the scenes. And so out of this miraculous situation, David, the one who was to be king, gets chosen to play the harp for the king. And Andy pointed out how David was just trusting God to work behind the scenes to accomplish God's purposes. But in this story, we have a little bit of a different picture of David. Here we see him trying actively to kind of move things along. So much so that his brother recognizes what he's doing and he gets mad at him. Listen to verse 28. Now Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men. And Eliab's anger was kindled against David. And he said, "Why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle." Now the brother's accusation is fascinating. He challenges David's heart. Now, if Saul's thing was that he was tall, David's thing is his heart. That's what's remarkable about him. He is a man after God's own heart. But here, his brother Eliab says, I know the evil in your heart. What do we do with that? Is it just one brother squabbling with another? Is the older brother just worried that the younger brother is going to show him up? Or is Eliab onto something that we don't know about yet? He is, after all, David's brother. He's grown up with him. If I think about my life, apart from my wife and children, my brother probably has had the clearest view of the evil in my heart. Growing up as brothers tends to do that. What do we do with this statement? It forces us as the reader to ask these questions. What does lie within David's heart? What are his motivations in doing this? And of course, David responds like any brother would. He says, what's the big deal? I was just asking a question. Come on. I was just talking. But as readers, we know he has an agenda. He was doing more than asking a question. He was getting at something. And he keeps asking the same question. As the story continues, he goes around to person after person saying, what's the reward? Is this really the reward? And finally, the king notices, because David is so interested in the reward, that's what brings him to Saul's attention. So he's invited before the king, and Saul looks at David and says, you can't do this. You're just a shepherd boy. You're not qualified for this task. So David tries to sell himself. He tries to convince the king that he's up to this task. Listen to verse 34 to 36. But David said to Saul, your servant used to keep sheep for his father. And when there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock, I went after him and struck him and delivered it out of his mouth. And if he rose against me, I caught him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has struck down both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, for he has defied the armies of the living God. And Saul says, I thought this guy just played harp. Who is this guy? It's a fascinating picture of David. So far, all we've known him as is the forgotten son and the gentle harpist, and now he's saying, I can handle lions and bears. He's got this bravado to him. He says, I used to keep sheep for my father, as in this morning I was keeping sheep for my father, right? It's not like he's graduated from being a shepherd. He says, a lion would come and I'd grab his beard and one-handed and he'd be lying dead on the path. You'd almost say David seems cocky here. He thinks he can handle anything. But Saul's not convinced. David goes through this whole speech and there's silence. Until verse 37, David speaks up again, trying one more time to convince the king. He says this, and David said, the Lord, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. That did the trick. And Saul said to David, go, and the Lord be with you. So David starts off bragging about his own abilities. But it's not until David says, the Lord is the one who delivered me then and who will deliver me now. That's when Saul is convinced. Saul's compelled by the idea that God would bring this victory. It's a perplexing scene. David is qualified, but he's still a bit of an underdog. He's confident in his abilities, but he's also confident in God, that God would give him the victory. And Saul seems pretty good. Saul says, I'm not going to let a shepherd do it, but if God's behind him, then I'm with God. Why does David really want to fight Goliath? And why does Saul let him? As far as David goes, he's complicated. He's ambitious and reward-driven. He's confident in himself, but also in the Lord. But here's the thing about David. He steps up. No matter what else we notice about David, when it comes down to it, he steps up to embrace the challenge. Not Saul. Saul shrinks back. I suspect that Saul, in this moment, probably thought that David was an easy solution. That's why Saul gives David his armor. He says, well, if I give David my armor and David wins, I can say, well, it was because of my generosity in providing the equipment to defeat the giant. But if David loses, Saul can say, well, he was only a boy. He was never going to win anyway. So Saul's kind of watching out for all the angles here. Of course, David won't be owned by Saul. So he says, no, I'm going to do this my way. I don't need the king's armor. And verse 40 builds up to the battle. Then he took his staff in his hand and chose 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in his shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. This is the David we love. It almost sends shivers down your spine. You know something great is about to happen. The shepherd with his staff and his pouch approach the giants. But before the battle, there's some conversation. In ancient times, they referred to this as trash talk. It's what you would say before any military competition. You try to psych the other person out, try to scare them, you know, get the mental advantage. So the Philistine mocks David and his little stick, and David replies with similar confidence. But listen to what he says in verses 46 to 47. This day, David says, the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head, and I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, regular trash talk, so that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves, not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. Embedded in this trash talk is a critical statement. David says that God will give him the victory. And David claims not just to know that he's going to win, but he claims to know why God will bring the victory here. He lists 2 reasons. One, so that all the world may know that there is a God in Israel. And 2, so that this assembly, that is God's people, Israel, would know that the Lord saves, not by sword and spear. If I had to summarize those motivations, I would say David says that God will give him the victory for the sake of God's reputation in the world and the faith of his people. We'll come back to those phrases again and reflect some more on them. But David wants the world to know about God, and he wants God's people to be confident in God's ability to save. And of course, David wins the victory. We all know that part of the story. He runs towards the giant. He spins his sling while it picks up a momentum, and he lets loose the rock that embeds itself in Goliath's forehead. Goliath falls to the ground, and he draws his own sword and cuts off his head. And that's all, the battle. It's over in a second. It only takes 4 verses of the 58 verses that tell this story. This is not an action story. There's very little action. It's a character study about David. And the battle is short because when you get down to it, David is better armed. We like to think of this as an underdog story, but it really isn't. Judges 20:16 tells us about the great warriors of Benjamin who could sling a stone at a hare and not miss. See, they recognized that projectile warriors were valuable. In fact, slingshotters were an essential part of a highly trained army. Goliath came expecting hand-to-hand combat with a sword and a spear. David comes with a projectile weapon. In our terms, David brought a gun to a knife fight. Of course he wins. But what's really important is what happens after he won. Immediately after Goliath is killed, the nation rises up. All the people come up. David steps up, and because of that, the nation rises up to follow him. Listen to verse 52. And the men of Israel and Judah rose with a shout and pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron, so that the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Sha'aram as far as Gath and Ekron. The nation scored a victory here. It wasn't just that David beat Goliath, the shepherd against the giant. It was that God's people were led in victory. Who is supposed to do that? The king. Who is supposed to defend the honor of God? The king. Who really does it? David. In all the places where Saul shrinks back, where Saul fails, David steps up. At the beginning of the story, we think that the tall king will take on the tall champion. But at the end of the story, the whole nation is following David. He's the one that looks like the king. And so the story ends and we're hopeful. We think that this guy David's going to do all right. Maybe, just maybe, he's going to be a good king. At least mostly a good king. Because we're all excited about the victory. We're all excited that Goliath is lying headless on the ground. But we can't forget about those little questions we had along the way. Remember that ambition? Remember the comment about the evil in his heart? The cockiness that it seemed like David had? How he was so fixated on the reward for this victory? Why did he accept this challenge? We're left asking the question, who is David? Was he acting out of ambition? Was this whole thing just a strategic political maneuver to ensure a position in the royal family and ascend to the kingship? Or was he offended that God's name was being marred and he wanted to step up to defend the holiness of the God of Israel? To put it simply, did David fight for his glory or for God's glory? I was talking to a friend recently who was trying to figure out whether to make a significant decision. He's a new Christian. He's passionate about the gospel. He wanted to serve God in big ways, and there was a decision before him that he thought he might be being led toward. But he asked this very specific question to me. He said, I just don't know whether I'm doing this for my glory or for God's glory. And this is the question that we ask of David. Whose glory is he really seeking? And it's frustrating, but I don't think this story gives us an answer. In fact, I think the story is designed to raise that question, not to answer it. Because the David we see here is a paradox. On the one hand, he was appalled that a Philistine would stand against the armies of God. On the other hand, he was ambitious and saw a professional opportunity. On the one hand, he was confident that God would protect him and that God would give him the victory. On the other hand, he knew that he had a superior weapon for the occasion and that he would win easily. Was David holy or ambitious? Did he trust in God or trust in himself? At the end of the day, we don't know what to think about David. Is David a forgotten youngest son? Is he a quiet, subservient harpist? Is he an ambitious and clever young man? Is he a skilled warrior? Is he focused on God and his glory? Is he a humble shepherd? Is he a natural leader? Is he a military strategist? Yes, 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 yes. David is all of those things and more. Here's my best attempt to summarize the David we meet in this story. David is an ambitious young leader who is confident in his ability and trusts that God will bring about a victory for the sake of God's reputation in the world and the faith of his people. In other words, David is complicated. He's human. His motivations are mixed. But he steps up and he takes action and he leads. With his whole heart, the good and the evil of it, David steps up and he leads. So what does that mean for us? What ought we to do? Well, I think we can recognize a lot of ourselves in David. His heart seems really familiar. I know it does to me. Maybe we don't know what to do with David, but we certainly don't know what to do with ourselves. What's really going on within us? Who are we? When I look at my own heart, I often don't know what to do with the mixture of things that I find there. Am I motivated by the things of this world, by selfish ambition, by pride? When I'm honest, I have to say yes, those things are there. Am I motivated by God's glory? Do I really authentically want to see God praised and his kingdom built for his namesake? I think I can honestly say I do. I want to see that with all my heart. How can those both be there at the same time? It's important to check our motivations because we're really good at making it seem like we're doing things for good reasons when in fact darkness lies beneath. So we need to ask these questions. Why am I doing this? We need people around us, our brothers who know us really well, to say, hey, I know what you're doing. I know what's really going on here. But I remember the day that one of my seminary professors said this. A man who had just celebrated 50 years of teaching in a seminary, training young Christian leaders, said, I have never done anything in my life from a pure motive. Never. Pure motives, I think, are an unreasonable goal. We can barely know our precise motives, much less ensure that they are 100% pure. If we wait to have perfect motives, we'll never do anything. We'll be stuck, paralyzed by our analysis. So here's my suggestion. Don't worry so much about whether you have bad motives. Worry about having good motives. Focus on good motivations for doing good things. You're going to be a mix. Just make sure that your good motives are really good. See, I think Saul and David both had their share of bad motivations. You could even argue that David's were worse than Saul's at times. But with Saul, you never see him with anywhere near as good motives as David. Saul and David might both have been bad, but Saul was never as good as David. When my friend was agonizing over this decision in his life, the answer seemed clear to me. It's not always the case, but in this case, I said, go for it. If the only thing holding you back is fear that maybe somewhere lurking are some bad motivations, go for it. Because I see the good motivations. I see your heart to glorify God. So take a step and let God deal with what's really in your heart. There's a similar incident in the New Testament. At one point during Paul's ministry, the apostle finds himself in jail. And while he's there, some people decide to preach about Jesus so that Paul would be more mistreated in jail. His friends come to him and tell him this and said, hey, these people are trying to make your life harder by stirring up trouble about Jesus. And Paul says this in Philippians 1:18. What then? What do I care, he says, only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, whatever the motivations are, Christ is proclaimed. And in that, I rejoice. They're doing something good. They're proclaiming Christ to the world. What do I care why they're doing it? So what about us? What about you? Do you shrink back in fear? Are you paralyzed by fear of why you might do things? Are you worried about making a mistake, about taking a wrong step? Or do you step up? Do you step forward? Do you rise to the challenge like David and see what God might do with it? Do you shrink back or step up? And let me suggest David's motives as incredible ones to compel us. From the moment I first started reading this story to prepare to preach it, verses 46 and 47 have just stuck with me. That all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves not with spear and sword. David is motivated by the reputation of God in the world and by the faith of his people. What could we do for those things? What do you do? How could you do the things you're already doing with those purposes in mind? The truth is, we live in a world where God's reputation is questioned every day. Our God does not look good to a lot of the people around us. He's accused of being malicious, of being sexist, of being homophobic, of being bigoted, of being mean and cruel and arbitrary and all sorts of things. What can we do for the sake of God's reputation in the world to demonstrate the love and the compassion and the care the heart for the vulnerable. How can we defend God's reputation to the world? And because of that, it's hard to believe in God. It's hard to follow Jesus. Having faith is tricky. It's tricky as a kid. It's tricky in adolescence and young adulthood and middle age. It's all the time hard. How can we encourage each other? How do we help each other know and believe daily, weekly, that the Lord saves us? Not with sword and spear, but with his son. We live in a place where we think so many other things might save us. How do we help each other remember that it is only God who saves? So let's step up for the sake of God's reputation and for the sake of our faith. When we do so, others might just follow, like David. When we step up, the nation might rise up. Our small groups, our friends, our families might rise up to follow us because they see something. They see us working for something good. What would that look like for you? To step up for the sake of God's reputation and the faith of his people. Well, I don't think the story of David and Goliath was given to encourage scrawny high school wrestlers. So if there are any of those in the room, I'm sorry. It certainly didn't do that for me. I think this story helps us to see David, a complicated, confusing man, but who does something good for the sake of God. It was given to us so that we could get this full introduction of this boy, this man, this king that we're going to spend 10 months finding out about him. We've met him as a forgotten son. We've met him as a gentle harpist. Now we've met him as this courageous warrior. But we still don't really know him. What really goes on in David's heart? And what really goes on in our heart? As the story concludes, the king, Saul, is asking exactly this question. Listen to verse 56. And the king said, after all of this, inquire whose son the boy is. Now, Saul had already met David. We already know that he knew him. But here he's saying, who is this guy? I thought he was just a harpist. Where did he come from? What is going on with this shepherd boy? And that's the question that we will continue to ask. How will this turn out? What will God do through him? What could God do through us? How does God really act in the world? Be careful, but don't be too careful. Step up in faith. Amen.